This is EVN Report, and you're listening to Up Close and Personal, a podcast that goes beyond the bylines and bios. I'm Maria Titizian, and in each episode, I sit down with a guest to explore the full story behind their work, the turning points, the quiet moments, the experiences that have shaped them. Journalists, academics, artists, and more. Some you'll know, some you'll be meeting for the first time. But all of them have something to say if we take the time to listen. Hello, welcome to EVN Reports, Up Close and Personal. Today, my guest in the studio is a really dear friend of mine, Artur Babian. He's a journalist, blogger, digital security expert, media consultant. He's the guy that every media professional in Armenia turns to when they have a problem. So welcome to the program, Artur.
Thank you for calling me.
The one thing I really wanted to ask is, what's the secret to you looking so young? That's a question you might ask a woman. The reason I ask is because when I found out that you had a son who was in the army, I think I had to pick my jaw up off the floor because you look like you're 30.
I have no time to grow old.
No time to grow old because you're going at like 180 miles an hour.
That's a combination of moving all the time, I guess.
Yeah. No, but seriously, how old are you?
I'm 46, turning 47.
Yeah, you look
closer
like you're 30.
Closer to 47.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Well, so I first heard about you. I was trying to remember when we first met, because I think it's a decade now that I know you, if not more. But I knew you as a blogger. You had this T-Dort site and you were active, and I knew that you were working at Azadutyun at the time or before then. But you have been on this media journey for almost two decades now. And there's a lot of things I want to unpack to understand who Artur is, because as I said, we all know Artur, but do we really know Artur? Do we really know you?
I don't think anybody really knows me, including myself. And that's the reason why nobody knows me, because I don't. I'm changing all the time, I guess. I'm iterating, and I don't even know. Like, I'm an old man, you know, in Armenian standard. Like, I'm ready to be a grandpa.
Grandfather.
but frankly, like, even today, I'm thinking maybe I should again change my profession. And this has happened.
I like that, because I'm like that
times,
too. Yeah.
To learn something new, sure. etc. And while doing that, I also have this very big thing about having commitments. Mm-hmm. If I go somewhere or do something, it's usually for a lifetime. Mm. That's why, like, I have also many heads, because if I start doing something,
I stick to it
for a long time. Even if I change and adapt to something new, I still keep the old things going.
Because you really have a lot of hats on, and you know, you've worked at the intersection of journalism, technology, and ethics, like I said, for about 20 years now. And before we talk about sort of the things that you do, because as I said, you have many, many hats. What was the moment, I mean, personal or professional, that first made you feel like this work was part of your purpose?
This will be maybe funny to you, but I went into media because I wanted computers. Well, to start it from the very start, I was an exchange student in the US in 95, 96. And if you know anything about Armenia those days, we had no computers for sure. Like maybe there were five in the country, and there was not even electricity to plug those computers in. And then I'm suddenly, like, I find myself in Silicon Valley in a high school. And I just took like crazy all the computer classes because it fascinated me so much. And then I'm coming back in 96, having learned like web design, HTML, even like looking at Cold Fusion, like new technologies and database kind of stuff. And I'm coming to Gyumri and there's not even electricity.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm going to conquer the world. I've learned how to build websites, you know, things like that.
But you need electricity.
Yeah. And I'm like,
and a Wi-Fi connection.
So what do I do with all this? And I'm in Gyumri, not even in Yerevan. And I'm going to the largest shop there is in Gyumri, and I'm like, hey, let me make you a website. Like I'm persuading, I'm selling this, like it's like cold call. I'm like, I'll build you a website. It's going to cost you like $30. Do you want it? I was like,
What's a website?
And the guy's like, there's literally two places in Gyumri where there's any computers at all. So I was like, okay, so this website and being a developer thing is not going to work. Nobody needs that. That's stupid stuff. And I discovered that there are computers in specific locations in Gyumri. For example, there was one in Sean TV studio. Mm. And I went there and they let me close to the computer because I knew English by that time very well. So I could translate for the guys working with the computer what's there on the screen. And so I kind of got dragged into it. I discovered that always all media outlets have some computers, which I am able to use. And I was mostly a technologist, a system administrator, etc. I started a tech blog back in 98, I think.
What was it called?
It was called 360 Mobile on Yahoo GeoCities. If anybody is an old inhabitant of internet, they will know there were GeoCities on Yahoo. It was sort of like a blog. Like, we didn't know it's a blog at that point.
I have no idea what that means, but okay.
Yeah, I mean, like, it was just a page on internet where I was writing, like, okay, so, you know, there is, like, a way to take a laptop in a suitcase. Like, there's a way to put a computer in a suitcase, bring a small mobile black and white screen to it, and it will be mobile and things like that. I was exploring those things. And then I kind of liked writing. Mm-hmm. And I was blogging technology stuff mostly.
And I'm just curious, you know, Armenian parents are, let's just say they're interesting when it comes to their children's choices for profession. What were your parents thinking when they saw, you know, your head deep into these things?
My parents, they're very supportive usually. And they sort of liked what I was into. I mean, like I was... Because I knew English and that was the only where I could get. Like I went into English language. So my main profession is linguist and teaching English as a first language. Mm. I actually even did some postgraduate study of English phraseology. But they were like, okay, so English is this popular new thing and our son is into it. And then like computers are those popular new things and our son is into it. And my father actually used to work for Sean TV company. So he sort of encouraged the fact that I was coming there and looking all cool and everybody coming and asking me questions. So I was like, okay, you know, like he's a student and he's doing these interesting things, always on the edge. Why not?
It's interesting. I always tell the story. I'm older than you, obviously. So when I was going into grade 9 high school, we had these elective courses we could take. So it was either typing, mm-hmm. like on a real typewriter. People, I don't know, young people have never seen one. Or computer programming. So I'm talking like, I don't know when I'm talking, like early 80s. Oh, and my dad says, Achigas, my daughter, computers, that's a passing phase. Do typing. Well, thankfully, I'm a really fast typer because of that class. But
yeah, I've
just
seen
goes
that.
To show how parents can sometimes, you know, either divert you from that path or encourage you unknowingly. So that's interesting. So you were probably one of the first people in Armenia who really understood this new technology, yeah?
I mean, I don't want to, like, you know...
You can.
Boast myself. But, yeah, I was always on the... they call it the bleeding edge because it's so sharp that you might get hurt sometimes.
Yeah.
I really like that. I'm always exploring those very, very new mm-hmm. ideas. So when there was this AI thing, I was right
yeah,
there.
Yeah, we're going to talk about AI in a minute.
When there was these NFTs or, show me new technology, I'll come running.
Yeah. See, there are certain things I don't understand. Like cryptocurrency, I don't understand blockchain. Like I hear these terms, or like it annoys me. Maybe because I still like the analog world in comparison. But we will talk about AI for sure. So you get your feet wet, and then when do you move to Yerevan?
I was trying to move to Yerevan for quite some time, mm-hmm. and for me, Yerevan was Zeytun district because that's where my aunt lived.
Okay.
So, like, even since we were a child, that's the only place I knew. Like, we knew that there is this Rossiya movie theater area where we landed in these mini buses, and then
from Gyumri,
and then go to aunt's place. I was taking part in some Olympiads as a kid as well. So, for me, Yerevan was this like very strange little things. So this Rossiya movie theater with all the hullabaloo around it. It was like an Asian market.
That's a good word, hullabaloo, yeah.
And then there was this Zaytun, which was our relatives, which felt like another part of Gyumri. And then in the middle. So for me, Yerevan had no special romantic things or anything. Okay. The only thing I knew about Yerevan was like, if anything real is happening, it's happening there. Mm. It's, if it's Olympiads, you come there in the central place and then you see somebody from Vartanis and you see somebody from Gyumri and somebody from Yerevan all come together. And I wanted, with my inclination to everything new and shiny, it was a logical place. I came here in 2003, I think. Mm. I moved for a real job. And it was a media job. It was Media Diversity Institute, a London-based organization. Mm-hmm. Was looking for a coordinator. Before that, I was like...
You also studied in the UK, though. Was this...
Yeah.
This was before or after?
No, no. UK was a short thing in 2007. It was a Chevening Fellowship.
Okay.
But I worked for a UK-based NGO or organization for quite some time by that time. Mm-hmm. And I came there because I was applying to all kinds of jobs and never getting any offers. I mean, because in Yerevan in early 2000s, it was all about connections.
Yeah.
And then this London-based organization, just like they hired me and they were like, yeah, you're above and beyond all the other candidates we looked at. And so just come in. So I was really happy to join it. And it was media, which was something I was already somehow engaged in and doing stuff. And it was a project to promote ethical reporting in Armenia. And
something we still struggle with.
It was actually a three-country project, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia. In those days, it was still possible to have some sort of projects like that. And we were discussing about conflict resolution as well, minority reporting, diversity reporting. And those were all things that felt native to me because in Gyumri, I was very different, you know,
as a person.
I mean, look, most of Gyumri were stuck in their little bubble and they were all about their this earthquake and our tragedy. Nobody had ever gone anywhere beyond Yerevan. And by that time, I'd been to France, been to US, been to Switzerland. Like, I traveled the world, seen lots of things. I had this very long hair.
Really?
And and a beard.
Okay, I have to see those pictures.
And look, when I was walking in Gyumri, there was always some asshole who was coming shouting. I'm sorry if I'm not supposed
please,
to say
words. We use all kinds of swear words.
Yeah, what the hell? Your long hair.
That was quite revolutionary for the time, Artur.
There were literally like three people with long hair in Gyumri at that time. Now Gyumri people have learned more not to react that much. But I was getting into fights. I mean, I also played the guitar. So I was like,
definitely.
Felt like I'm this rocker guy. And I got like hits on my guitar, I got hits on my laptop. I had a PowerBook in those days. My MacBook was broken once because I couldn't, like, being grown in a Gyumri environment, I also couldn't not react.
Sure.
When somebody was shouting, like, things like that, I was like, what's your problem, man? So I got really sick and tired of Gyumri, frankly. And now when everybody compliments Gyumri and they say Gyumri is so lovely, etc., I tried to keep it in me, but frankly, at some point, I was sick and tired of Gyumri and the fact that they don't like anybody who looks a little bit different or knows things a little bit like other than others. So I felt that this media diversity thing is something that's really native and this country needs that, you know, needs to embrace a little bit of diversity. And by that time, I also explored a lot of economic theories and complexes because in US, I saw things so very different because when I went, we were still in Soviets. Mm-hmm. And then I went to this totally different environment. I was like, why is it so different? And when I was exploring this, for example, in my high school, which was a crazy place, honestly. It was Salinas High School, like people dressed radically differently. People of all nationalities. And then I'm coming from Gyumri environment where everybody...
Mono-ethnic, like,
you're supposed
conservative.
To have short hair cut right from your ears, like buds. You're not supposed to move, behave differently. And I'm like, what if this being different and being able to, you know, dress differently and look differently, what if that also encouraged your growth and progress, things like that? So those things were starting to tickle into me. I was lucky to come across a Peace Corps library in Gyumri, like a lot of books, all of them in English. And I noticed that nobody actually reads those. And I was like swallowing them one by one. And there were things about business, economic theory, and computers.
Of
Frankly,
course.
Everything started with a manual how to use Microsoft Word on Windows 3.1.1. But after that, I discovered there were many, many more interesting books. And I was like reading all of them. I was getting all these ideas about what I want this country to look like. And I had already started the technology blog, and I was like, okay, this is clearly not enough. I need to, you know, write more about more diverse topics. So sort of this was a function of me learning things and thinking that I need to share and I need to do something, not just like learn and keep it inside.
It's fascinating. It's fascinating because when I look at you now, I could never imagine that you were this, I'm going to say radical, because that was a radical expression at that time. Because, you know, if Yerevan was conservative in the early 2000s, Gyumri was like super conservative. It still is, I think, in many ways, in comparison to other parts of the country. So for you to have done that, it's quite fascinating. So you move in 2003, you're working for the Media Diversity Institute. And then when did you join RFERL?
2008. I went and did this testing in August 2008, and then I went there in September and stayed for quite a while, for 11 years.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons I went there was because in 2008, in March 1st, there were the clashes. Mm-hmm. Actually, I all started in 2007 when like there were the opposition things. And I, as a blogger, as a very active writer, I was writing, contributing, and I was reading RFERL stuff. Not as much listening to it, but reading most of it. And I felt that if there's any outlet in this country which is able to actually get the point across and is not afraid to cover stuff, at that point I felt that it was RFERL. And knowing of the environment at that point, it was total silence for some while.
Yes.
A1 Plus had been taken off the air.
That's
some
right.
Others were like exemplary. There were court trials against some media outlets.
It was a different time.
A very coordinated, like things were in the hands of a couple of media oligarchs, everything under control. And I felt that I want to contribute constructively. That's where I should go. My media outlet, it was eChannel. It was a Media Initiative Center, had a news website to cover elections in 2007, 2008. And in 2008, it was one of the websites which was taken off the air. And RFERL's websites were sort of blocked or something. I was actually taking some stuff from A1 Plus, RFERL, and publishing it in one of my, like I had several blogs because I like backups. It's a different thing. I had a number of websites. I had my YouTube channel was had tens and thousands of views of those days.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's when I first heard about you, perhaps, because I was working for the Armenian Reporter at the time. And, you know, I covered March 1. And then when there was a state of emergency or martial law or whatever it was, I remember because we were published in the United States. Our office was here in Yerevan, but we would publish the paper there. And I remember one day somebody from what we called the KGB, I guess the NSS, came to our office and said, you know, martial law, you can't publish this. And I said, you know, we publish in the United States, so that doesn't apply to us. But after he left, I was in the washroom almost throwing up. I was so scared because it was a very unnatural thing for me at the time. So yeah, interesting times. And then you were there for many, many years at RFERL doing a lot of important work.
I was doing sort of very like me. I was doing both like journalism, editorial work, like day-to-day journalism. Mm-hmm. But I was also engaging with lots of technology and innovations at RFERL. That was the times when RFERL's service director, Harry Tamrazian, he had big ideas about new multimedia and TV, etc. And I was that guy who was...
making it happen.
Like, I mean, it was Harry making it happen, but I was like doing the technological stuff and work with that. It was a whole team doing it, but... yeah, I was in a very good cross-section with my knowledge of technology and understanding of media to appreciate those ideas and try to really explore new technologies and put them in work. So at some point, RFERL was, frankly, the most influential media outlet at some times. especially I remember those days when the Opera Square, the Liberty Square, was circled by police officers, and then like with live streams we were, you know, following the opposition protests and crossing into those. And there was like total silence in the country, in TV, etc. Mm-hmm. And then
it was like nothing was happening.
There were a few, pioneers, RFRL, there were A1+, CivilNet was just opening up those days, I think, in the early days when these protests were happening. So this internet TV thing was something new that was making a
dent.
But
it changed our perception of the world in so many ways. I remember actually it was the Maschtots Park protests.
Yes.
At the time, that's when I remember, because my son was working at CivilNet at the time, and they were live streaming using their laptops because they didn't have the live stream equipment. And
the first live streams of RFR were actually on my personal device, on my personal laptop.
Yeah.
Because and I had this little netbook with very underpowered computer and the webcam that I experimented with.
Oh my God, webcams,
And I was like, and radio people thought like we're literally crazy.
Mm.
I mean, Harry and I was like, I'm not take my personal laptop because they wouldn't really want to us to do anything else. They were like, take a real camera, go and make a shoot, and then bring it and publish it on YouTube. I was like,
no.
I know how to do this. Let's try to live stream. Yeah, that's something different.
And I think it was actually, you know, that's when it was like an aha moment where we said, okay, the traditional media is now all of a sudden upended, and now we have this internet media who are able to bring us in real time what's happening. It was fascinating actually to experience and see that. I want to switch gears a little bit. You've been outspoken about Armenia's digital vulnerabilities, because I don't even know if we should get into it, but especially after the 2020 war. And like I said at the top, you are the guy that we come to, at least we do here at Event Report. Whenever you know I need something, I'm calling you or I'm sending you a message. On a personal level, how does it feel to constantly navigate and sound alarms about threats that sometimes people never see? And just before we started the podcast, we were talking about media literacy. We don't see the threats, but you are the guy that somehow is always the one at the forefront of that. How does that make you feel?
Well, one thing I've learned is if you want to do something, you just do it for a long time. You know, like you want to make a change, you want to start live streaming, you want to change people's perceptions about security, just keep doing it and not pay any attention to like you obviously, you know, don't do crazy. I measure success. I try to see if it's these my messages that are getting across. And one of the reasons I really eagerly came for this interview is because I also know that there's an interesting, important demographic listening to your content, and I want to reach out to those people as well and just keep on doing it. I feel sometimes that it's like, I don't know, if I'm doing a wasteful thing, like wasting all my energy on things, and then people still won't change.
Mm.
But because I'm also all into analytics and I look at statistics and I see that my reach is growing, my co-founder Samvel Martins, his reach is again above the charts, and our profiles are reaching, people are reacting, people are reaching out to us, and it's mostly like measuring and not being too ambitious. I don't get, you know, disillusioned fast. I don't get disappointed fast.
No, you are the
fast.
Most optimistic person I know, and it's really annoying sometimes, to be honest, because I'll be complaining about something. You're like, it's okay, Maria-chan, you know. It's like, damn it, just be angry, you know. But you never are, it seems. You're perpetually optimistic. And actually, you and Samvel, if you remember, were the people I came to when, back in 2016, I had been targeted by Fancy Bear, that Russian hacking group or whatever it was, and I remember writing to Samvel saying, Samvel, and he's like, Yeka, what's wrong?
And then
you are the people we go to. But I am going to ask the question. I'm sorry, you're going to have to answer it. What makes you angry, Artur? Like, not only professionally, as a citizen, as an Armenian, as a father, as a, I don't know, friend, what is it that makes you angry?
I mean, I don't get angry easily, but I guess injustice makes me angry. For example, I'm very, very angry these days about this new bill the government has brought.
Which bill? There's many.
Which
ones.
Is...
About the army.
People call it evading army service.
Yeah.
And this bill, like me as a father of two sons, one of whom has already served in the army, it feels like such a total injustice. Mm-hmm. And it also feels like... If this bill passes, it feels like I'm nothing, you know, because right. my son served in the army and the second one is going to go. And then there are some fathers who are going to
pay
their way out of that. More things that make me angry is the fact that, for example, my son has some, you know, like he had some operation right before the army because he had some health problems. And I mean, you see, he's a computer guy with eyeglasses, programmer. He went and served and he did in this military service. And then I come to my street and then I see those guys, his age, looking much healthier, no glasses, nothing, and nothing to do, just hanging out and not even serving in the army because all of them are citizens of Russia or something, you know, like, or some other countries. This is also another injustice. And the government says that their bill is going to address exactly this problem, that people evade army service by changing their citizenship. And I see everything wrong with that because our army is a place that you want to avoid at all costs.
And that's the crux of the problem. It shouldn't be
so
that
you
way.
Fix the army. Damn army. You know,
exactly.
Like I've been in the army camp in Switzerland on some study tours. And that's the kind of army you just want to go and not come back. You know, like
I know.
It's...
I can't remember. I don't want to say which ambassador. I think it was the Finnish. Doesn't matter. And about their mandatory service and how every young man and every family looks forward to sending their sons to do their mandatory military service because it's a place where they go and they learn and they are trained. Here, everybody does everything to avoid it. And the whole, for me, the justification was ridiculous from the government when they said that, well, you know, this informal money being transferred is happening anyway, so let's just formalize it. Well, stop the process. Stop it.
Yeah.
Right? It's all about political will, right? And fixing what's wrong in the army so that, you know, I always say I have three grandsons. And, you know, in a matter of 5-6 years, my oldest will be going off to the army. You as a father, your wife, I mean, having to experience that when my son-in-law went to the army, it was almost like as if we were sending him off to prison. It shouldn't be that way. Fix the damn army. Okay, what else makes you angry?
It's mostly injustice.
Yeah,
like, frankly, yeah. I mean, Ilham Aliyev makes me angry all
sure.
the time.
Okay.
Pashinyan makes me angry.
Let's not talk.
Paul, but that's not the kind of, like, the real times when I actually feel angry is when I feel there is injustice.
Yeah.
And then, you know, some people
because
are
you're
getting
doing everything
way.
As a citizen, your rights and responsibilities, you are enacting them, you are partaking in them, and then you see others not doing it. Yeah, I hear you.
I really like paying taxes, for example.
Sure.
And one thing that makes me angry is when I see how people evade those taxes.
Mm-hmm. And then yet they want every service available.
Yeah. And then they demand, I like keeping everything in, like, my house, this is how it was drawn on the plans, that this is exactly what I should do. I do it.
You're not going to go 3 meters outside
of
that.
And when I see, like, what neighbors are doing, like putting this here and there, and then a police
crazy.
Officer comes and they, like, give the cash out and tell them to go away.
Yeah.
Like, those things make me angry. But one thing that also pisses me off completely is when that same neighbor who violated, like, the plans, and because of that, the street looks like, I don't know, strange, you know, in design, like, think that, like, everything's so weird, etc. And it's like, this country is never gonna improve, of course, but you're not gonna let it, you know.
Look at your own actions, right?
Yeah, people, I don't know.
I have to tell you the story, Artur. So, the other day, I was at Yerevan Dialogue, right? This big event that the MFA puts on every year, which is fine. So, you know, we're going into the hall, and there's metal detectors because prime ministers are there, whatever. It's fine. It's normal. Okay. So there's only one metal detector that has the I don't know what you call it, where you put your bag, right? Mm. So the other three, if you don't have a purse or a bag, you just walk through. So there's a lineup because we all have bags or backpacks or whatever. And there's this woman who's behind me, but I see that she's sidling up and she, And then she cuts in the line. She places her bag in front of, and there, you know, there are people from Europe, from all over the, you know, there's ministers and whatever. It doesn't matter. We're all people. She places her bag and she cuts through the line and she passes through. And I was talking, there was a colleague beside me, and I said, you know, I could handle war. I can handle Aliyev. I can handle all of the bullshit, right? The security concerns. As a journalist, I'm ready for that. This kind of behavior, I can't handle, right? And it turned out she was Armenia's ambassador to a country, which I will not say, because then you'll know who she is. This woman represents my country in Europe, and then she's cutting in front. Now, you might say, okay, you know, it's just a line. Somebody else might say, it's just an extra room that they built, or an extra floor that they placed. All of these little things add up to make us crazy.
I mean, fully agree. Like, this is exactly the kind of stuff I'm talking about. Yeah. Same on the street. Like, you're almost at the...
Oh, my God. Yeah. The street. The walk. I have walking rage. Not car rage. I have walking rage.
Yeah. Cars never give you way. Or even if you're driving, somebody cutting in the line of the cars. And then
it's insane.
You know, this
It
this
makes story, us all insane.
I used to have a Niva. This is important.
Oh, you're one of those.
Yeah, but that's the first reaction. But I used to drive a Niva for about 10 years.
Okay.
And Niva is a specific type of car.
Yes.
I mean, it's a shitty car. It's not even a car. But I mean,
it's a good, you know, if you want to go up a mountain, it's good.
But in Yerevan, especially in the 2000s, mid-2000s, Niva represented something like it's this opera, these kind of, you know, guys who don't care about,
no rules.
Rules, etc. And I had the Niva because I was going to various events in Tsakhkadzor, Averan, in winter, as a trainer, as a journalist, or traveling to. So I needed the Niva for work. But after Niva, I sort of like, I sold it and I bought a...
Opel.
Very like modern looking, family looking, you know, Honda.
Okay.
And I couldn't drive in Yerevan. I felt that something has changed.
Stop it.
Like, honestly, like the city had changed in one day. I couldn't drive. Like, everybody was going over me, nobody giving me way. And I understood that it was the Niva. People, when they saw it's a Niva, they wouldn't dare to cross you.
Yeah.
They wouldn't dare to, you know, like signal you. And when I changed to something which was a more family looking car, I literally couldn't drive. Like, I was like, the whole city has changed. Like, what? People got crazy or what? Like, I'm coming to the crossroad, nobody giving me way.
Yeah, when you have a big car, it's easier to drive.
In Armenia, people look at your appearance, you look at your car, look at your clothes, and that determines how they treat you.
Of course, this is, I guess,
the moral of the story.
Yeah.
And that's maybe also one of the things that I don't like, because I'm fairly like casual. I like jeans, etc. But now I'm more and more forced to, you know, put a nice shirt and things like that. So some people will not talk to me otherwise. Yeah. And that also pisses
because
me
we're
off.
Because we're obsessed with the outside package all the time.
Yes.
I remember I always used to say that Armenia is like this beautiful gift, right? All packaged with pretty paper and a big bow, but inside it's empty. Right, we have to stop. We have to look at the core and look at the substance, and we don't. And that's from driving to walking to professional relations. All of these things are impacted by it. But coming back to what you do, you've mentored journalists. You've developed VR training tools, which we've also experienced, which is really cool. You've embraced AI. Yeah, with caution, because you are one of the few people who talk about ethics and AI, and that's another story I'll talk about later. What's one thing you hope the next generation of Armenian media professionals will do differently from our generation, as they have to embrace these new tools? And
well, for starters, I hope there are still some Armenian media professionals left in the future, because my view of the future is pretty grim. I feel that the whole trends are going in a way that we will have a lot of influencers and very, very few media left.
Yep.
And media that will be of any value will be maybe the type of media which has some public support, some sort. It can be budget money allocations or public support in terms of subscriptions and subsidies or even grants, which is, again, a form of government money just coming from some other government, which is sad for me. But the fact that this is happening, another thing that is happening, I feel that these big AI companies will take over and they will start hiring journalists to quality control their stuff. So many, many journalists and media will move to the back end of the AIs and people will be interacting with media through some AIs.
Yeah.
So you will wake up and your AI assistant in the house will tell you what you have planned for today. And based on your plans, what news is relevant for you to know, the weather, or if there's a government session on your usual route, so you move the other way, or if you should buy more fuel because the fuel's prices are going to go up. This type of highly customized media is the next thing. And because I feel that these trends are coming, what I hope for the Armenian media professionals, even if there's no media left, I mean, there will be some, is to be really, really ethical and to be very, very determined with their facts. Like to check them all the time, to double check them, mm-hmm. and not to trust. Because we're in the area of post-truth when, I mean, government, people, rulers, presidents will be saying, will be lying bluntly, and they're just, you know, refusing that they even said that. And even you, if you face them with the facts. So media professionals, if we want to bring any value and if we want to survive, if we want to make sure there's some need of us left, is to fact check and to be highly ethical and keep our integrity. Because integrity will differentiate if you're a media or you are an influencer. Because influencers take money and sell their influence.
Mm-hmm.
And many of the Armenian media today, newspapers, even websites, etc., they're actually influencers. They're selling their audience and money to specific people for specific interests. They're not serving an audience. They don't even care about the audience. Sometimes I talk to them about growing their audience and trying to monetize it. And they're like, they're not saying it upward, but they're like, why should I struggle and accommodate to 200,000 separate individuals who are the audience if I can just cater to one person? And that one person likes me and gives me the money, and then I
that's all I care about.
So if I can just like serve one person, make this person happy and get all the money I need and sell my influence, why not just like stick to that and go with that?
So I was on a Zoom call with some media professionals a few weeks ago talking about AI and journalism. An organization wants to do some training and whatnot. And three times very specifically, I said, we need to talk about ethics of using AI in journalism. And it was like, pfft. And somebody said, AI is here. We can't avoid it. Sure, of course, I acknowledge that mm-hmm. AI is here. I'm not saying I don't use it, I do use it as well. But I know how to use it, when to use it, and when not to use it, right? And it was just like, yeah, it's here so we can use it. And you know, having this post-Soviet culture of plagiarism, which is rampant in our country, everyone's just putting everything on AI. I can tell when an article has been written with AI. I know it, right? How do I stop it? How do I control it? How do we use it ethically? Yeah, and be honest about how we're using it, right? So these are things that, yeah, it scares me. It's like somebody says, it's like the calculator. It is not like the calculator, right? Sure, when I was little, my dad said, no, you can't use the calculator. Your brain will rot, right? But AI is making people not think anymore.
Yeah, we're literally losing the skills.
Yeah, see, the thing is with us, we learned the skills, right? We grew up in an analog society, so we have the skills. So when we use AI, we use it specifically for certain things. But what, you know, my grandson says to me the other day, he goes, Dad, he goes, just, you know, I don't want to say in Armenian, he goes, just download ChatGPT on your phone. Let's just use like, are you kidding me? I said, you need to use your brain. You need to be able to think. You need to be able to process things, right? But it is a very, very scary time.
I agree 100%. I see nothing wrong with having the ChatGPT on the phone, for the record.
I don't.
And I mean, like, I see a future where these AI companies, they're going to need people who are able to actually think logically and process information and fact check them, because the direction AI is going, I mean, it's developing fast, although I have some projections that maybe we're going into another AI winter, because this AI thing is not new.
Mm.
Since the 70s, I was always into this science fiction kind of stuff, and I was reading this story how in the 70s, AI will do things for us. And then it was, and then there was this AI winter where there was less research and people were less determined to put stuff into it. And then there is another hype cycle, I think. Machine learning, etc. So this is another wave. If there is no very big breakthrough very soon in the technology, because I feel that these LLMs, GPT technologies, the stuff that we're seeing now, they are almost at the verge of hitting a limit. The good thing is that maybe they will calm down on development and try to use about, think about practical applications of the technology, which is already super amazing. Like it's doing stuff that's amazing, and we need to, you know, calm down a little bit. Stop pursuing these super new models, etc., and just think about actually real life applications, because those are multiple. In our sphere, for example, in digital security or media, there are huge applications. They can improve our process. They can help us bring more value if we do it in a calculated manner, if we understand what we're doing, if we're ethical, fact check, and don't lose our audience overnight to the media. Because one of the things that, again, these media trainings, journalists say, let's start using AI to publish stuff. And I'm like, what if the audience just throws you out of this circle? They just directly go to AI, because if you're going to do the AI anyway, why do they need you? You know, so the value that you are supposed to bring
nuance,
is to
context,
exactly,
all of these
like
things.
These things that AI cannot do. This is where your value is. And if you concentrate on that, you can improve your process. You can become faster, but you can also still bring the value for the audience. Because also with this AI, we're facing an Ouroboros, you know, this snake that eats its own tail. There's AI has already digested all the text there is on the internet. And now on the internet, what we're seeing is the AI generated text. And AI is in a vicious circle of consuming the same text that it is also already producing. So
culture
the
eating
people
itself,
who are actual people who are actually generating and putting some thought into their process, they're going to stand out and they're going to bring the bigger value. And this is me, again, being optimistic as
yes, and giving me and inspiring me not to be so doomsday about it. Arthur, on your Instagram, you share, you're a really good photographer. I don't know, do you use a camera? Is it your phone? I'm not sure, but you share snapshots of, I don't know, travel, bridges, sunlight, quiet beauty, let's call it. What do those little things give you that your work in media and digital security doesn't?
I like and appreciate beauty. I went to a very good photographer friend at some point and he trained me. So some of my photos could be with a proper digital camera. Some of those photos can be with an iPhone, because in photography, it's not the equipment that matters, it's the photographer. But I am also, in the 90s, I was all about appearances, long hair, etc. Now I try not to be that obvious. So my Instagram, for example, is about little things that I like. But I also share them, like, for example, travels. I only post them after I've come back to Armenia, for example, not to compromise my whereabouts. Not that I'm doing anything
dangerous. You really
need
to train the Armenian people.
And I'm like, okay, let's not be too revealing. This Instagram is mostly for myself, because I see it more of, I mean, like, I have lots of followers in various profiles, but let's face it, whatever I put out there is mostly for myself, because I'm the one who's most frequently look at it, and I look at it and it gives me snippets of joy.
And pleasure.
Things that I like. Yeah. For example, I like those street holes and things like that.
The manholes, they're beautiful.
I don't like the name manhole, I call them service. But I think
they're called manholes.
Literally the name. Yeah. I just don't like, because there's the name man in there, and I'm like, maybe some women might use them for service works. It's all about gender, but frankly, I really find fascinating manholes everywhere, and even in Yerevan, in front of the opera, like, there's this four very beautiful ones, which, like, every time I go there, I'm like, so cool that
we have
something
them.
Proper.
It's beautiful. I was looking at them and thought, geez, he has a really good eye. Do you still play the guitar?
Rarely, like, I have guitars, several of them, but I rarely play them, and I don't play them very well. I really like it. Mm-hmm. Like I might spend hours on it at the time, but usually I don't have time for that, which is a pity.
Okay. So what's your guilty pleasure song?
I like, yeah, that's a hard one.
The one you'd never admit to liking, but that you know the words to, or
you know, there is this Apata on YouTube.
Oh,
it's a kid song. It just takes me.
Sorry, I know, but I like that song too.
And my colleagues know that sometimes, like under my nose, Apata, and they're like, come on, like. People know that I genuinely have proper music taste. Like yeah. I like Bach, for example, sure. quite okay, a lot. Okay. And I like rock and all. But like these songs, sometimes it gets
happy.
Into my head. Yeah. And I like happy. And
I like that. Too.
Really, like I don't care about like the type of music. I can also like Tata. Like
no,
once okay, a while,
I hear you. I hear you. No, I get it.
But this one is like really embarrassing.
No, but <that's>
so now I'm here all vulnerable, you know.
Okay. If you could keep only one gadget for the rest of your life, what would it be?
That's the scariest question in my life.
One gadget. Is it your little iWatch there or?
It's going to be my Android phone, specifically Android phone. Not the iPhone, which I like more, but the Android, because I'm able to do much more on the Android because the system is much more open. But I hate the idea of having just one gadget.
Because it's just a question, Artur.
I've never thought of it because if you know about me, it's all about like I always
know.
Have to have two phones. I have to have two computers.
That's why I
at
asked
least.
You the question.
Like, I have to have a backup. You know, if I don't have it, I literally will go crazy.
Okay. All right. Late night snack of choice.
I buy these little raffinate cubes of sugar, like. Cubes of sugar. In the 90s, when I was reading a book, and I mean, because
there was nothing in the 90s.
Like, frankly, we were poor. Like, we used to have these cubes of sugar where my mother was keeping them because then she was making preserves when the season was coming. And I was stealing them because, like, I was taking, I was leaving the front row, but taking stuff from the back. And when I was reading, I was just like chewing on those sugar cubes. And even now, like in my house, I have this cube of sugar.
And that's your guilty pleasure.
And if I like, I can't sleep and I'm nervous and etc. And I know sugar is poison and like
that's
there's
okay.
like,
yeah.
it's demonized all over the place with YouTubers etc. But I will go and take one cube of sugar and maybe a little water or tea and then I'll just like chew on it and it's very loudly like it's not nice, but I like that. I don't know why.
Okay, what's the last photo you took on your phone, and why?
I have to look, but I was in Prague recently, and I don't think I've posted anything yet on my Instagram because that's my policy. But, you know, Prague is a beautiful city.
It is.
Like, you literally want to photograph it all.
Yes,
and I then know. At some point you give up. So it's probably
something
one of those
Prague.
Photos in Prague.
Tea or coffee?
To my coffee?
Tea or coffee?
Tea or coffee?
Chai.
Coffee for sure. I don't even think I can survive without it.
Sure, I think all of us.
Yeah, I've even made a little Google map for myself of coffee houses in Yerevan,
of course
categorized.
Of course you have.
Yeah, so I categorize. I have a friend.
What's your favorite coffee shop in Yerevan?
This really varies because of on my mood. Because for example, I
like today. Where would you go?
Today I'd go to Hikes, which is on Sarian Street. It's I think it's a Syrian Armenian guy who has it, and he has very good blends of coffee, but I also like the environment. But like I said, like depending on my mood, I might just like something to, I really like Lumen, for example.
Yeah,
then there is a Garage Coffee.
Yes.
Can't really predict. I used to drink the cheapest coffee and feel happy.
As long as it's coffee,
then
I'm
these
good.
Nice coffee house shops sprang up, and I have a Ukrainian friend who used to travel to Armenia quite a lot, and he was like teaching me about coffee, etc. And I tell him like, "You ruined me. I was happy with 100 dram coffee, and now I have to pay
2,500 dram,
twice as much just to feel that I'm drinking something proper." Like, go away. But yeah, I appreciate good coffee for sure.
Okay, what's a small daily ritual that keeps you sane? Is it drinking coffee?
No, I constantly listen to podcasts. Mm. At some point, I even think that I'm a podcast listening machine, and that's my if I'm angry, I'm frustrated, I don't know what to do, I'm reaching out to my earphones and listening to podcasts. Some platforms even tell me that I'm a freak because I'm listening to podcasts more than I'm awake or kind of stuff.
Okay. I know you're a football fan. Who's your favorite football team?
It's Aston Villa, which is very strange. It's a football and it's soccer. I mean,
it's
not American football, obviously. So it's a football team from Birmingham, UK. Because I was a student there, and one of the first matches in my life that I saw in actual, like, real Premier League football was Aston Villa, Arsenal. And I like both of those teams. And Aston Villa was in relegation, in very bad shape for many, many years. And my son is a fan of Arsenal, and he was always making fun of me, like, what is this crappy team that you're... Now it's back into the Premier League, and kept stuck to it, like, all the time, even when it was in a very bad shape. I was struggling to find the same thing.
When you mate for life, right? You commit for life.
I guess, almost. Yeah, that's another indication. Like, I really don't care if this is the good team or bad team. If
like
it's my
team,
then I'm sticking to it.
Your team. Okay, final question. If you could have dinner with any journalist, living or dead, who would it be and what would you ask them?
Oh... This is an amazing question. There's so many, but there is a journalist that I would really like to meet and ask questions. Is Tigran Avdalyan.
Who was killed,
who was maybe somewhat controversial, It's more like actual journalism speaking in me. There's so many questions that I would like to ask him, especially about how the camera crew went into the Armenian parliament in 1919, etc. And the guy himself, he was a very talented journalist, and I really liked when I was watching him. Amazing person, etc. Such a loss. But also, there are actual questions to ask him and get answers that could, you know, potentially change a lot of things.
Artur, thank you for this wonderful conversation. It was a real pleasure talking to you and getting to know you in a way that I hadn't before. So thank you for being honest and a little vulnerable.
Thank you for having me and pulling out this news about Epata Apata song.
And that's the song you're going to be listening to right now as we sign out. Artur Babyan, always a pleasure. Thanks for listening to Up Close and Personal. If you enjoyed this episode, please follow and share the podcast wherever you get your shows. Until next time.